Rusty James. Biff Wilcox looking for you, Rusty James. He says he's gonna kill you, Rusty James.
Man, me and you, we could have run this whole side of town if you just gave me a chance.
You know, if you're gonna lead people, you have to have somewhere to go.
I wonder why somebody hasn't taken a rifle and blown your head off. The motorcycle boy.
You always try so hard to be like your brother, Rusty James.
Hey, my brother's the coolest.
Why do you dislike me so much? I mean, I've always tried to be your friend.
You know, you might have made it a while on the Motorcycle Boys rap, but you ain't got your brother's brains.
Neither, contrary to popular belief, is your brother crazy.
To The Complete Works, an in-depth look into the career of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey exploring the ins and outs of true cagedom is my friend and co-host,
Mike DiCriccio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. I'm excited. I'm glad you're back. You've joined us in the world.
Yes, trip. Yes, we took a break for a couple of weeks so I can go on a journey, one might say. did a road trip to Colorado and back. It was pretty great. But now I'm back, ready to talk about movies. Mike, are you with me? Are you still there?
I'm still here, yes.
Okay, you broke up for like a second.
Curse you, internet. I miss our studio.
Yeah, the studio is nice. The studio is good.
Maybe one day.
Perhaps.
We'll break back into... Never mind. Forget it.
All right. Well, today we are talking about a movie released in 1983 that was directed by Francis Ford Coppola and based on a book by S.E. Hinton. The film stars people like Matt Dillon, Diane Lane, and Glenn Withrow, and the story concerns young teenage gang members in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and how they're forced to grow up in a violent life of crime. But enough about The Outsiders, Mike.
I was going to say, wait, did I watch the wrong movie?
Let's talk about Rumblefish.
Oh, okay.
Boom! All right, great.
Nailed it.
This week, Mike and I will be taking a look at Nicolas Cage's first collaboration with his uncle, Francis Ford Coppola, in 1983's Rumblefish. We've previously discussed on the show that Cage changed his name from Coppola to avoid charges of nepotism in Hollywood, but that didn't stop him from appearing in three of his uncle's movies early in his career.
Weird. That seems like a weird choice for him, but...
Yeah, I mean, you know, whatever works.
It worked, I guess.
It's like, you know, you get rid of the name, so people aren't like, well, you're Francis Ford Coppola's nephew, so obviously you're going to be Francis Ford Coppola's movie.
Right.
But you can still use your connection to Francis Ford Coppola to be in Francis Ford Coppola movies.
All right, that makes sense.
You know, it's whatever.
Yeah, we'll let it go.
Yeah. So Coppola made Rumblefish at the same time as he made The Outsiders, but he approached it very differently. While The Outsiders is, by all accounts, a relatively conventional teenage drama, Coppola used Rumblefish as an opportunity to really experiment with the style. Rumblefish is filmed in black and white, the score to the film by Stuart Copeland is almost entirely percussion-based, and there are several dream sequences throughout the film that give it an almost ethereal quality. The result is a unique and very daring film. But that kind of experimentation is almost always divisive, and Rumblefish was not well received upon release. Some critics felt it was impossible to be drawn into the movie and thought that there were too many obtrusive elements for it to be successful. Time magazine's Richard Corliss called it Coppola's bravest film, but also his most self-indulgent. Other critics, like Roger Ebert and Jay Scott, saw great things in the film, calling it daring, offbeat, and revolutionary. Likewise, the film didn't do so well at the box office either. On a budget of $10 million, the film made about $2.5 million. Movies like this tend to get overlooked in Coppola's career. After making four of the best movies ever made in the 1970s, The Godfather, The Conversation, The Godfather Part II, and Apocalypse Now, his career from the 80s onward is more hit or miss. But the result is that genuinely great films like Rumblefish sometimes get forgotten, and so I'm glad we're able to finally talk about it today. So, are you ready, Mike?
Yeah, yes, I'm very excited.
Yes, all right, so Mike and I are going to discuss the movie in detail first, and then move on to discussing Nicolas Cage's role in the film. Rumblefish is a movie that stars Nicolas Cage as Smokey, a member of Rusty James's gang. Rusty James, the film's lead, is played by Matt Dillon, and the film also stars Mickey Rourke as Motorcycle Boy, Vincent Spano as Steven, Diane Lane as Patty, Dennis Hopper as Father, Diana Scarwood as Cassandra, Chris Penn as B.J. Jackson, Lawrence Fishburne, then Larry Fishburne, as Midget, William Smith as Officer Patterson, Glenn Withrow as Biff Wilcox, Tom Waits as Benny, and Sofia Coppola as Donna. The film was directed by Francis Ford Coppola and written by Coppola and S.E. Hinton, who also wrote the book upon which the film was based. Now, with all that said, Mike.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Rumblefish?
I want to know why I had never heard of this movie before, because I was not expecting it to be anything. I was saying before we started recording that I thought it was kind of just be maybe like Valley Girl, which I had heard of, but something that's just like, oh, whatever, it's an 80s movie. They're, you know, right. Didn't do anything.
Right, you went into this movie basically completely blind.
Yes,
so to speak.
Which I feel ashamed of. I probably should have known that this was an S.E. Hinton novel before going in.
Perhaps.
But just as an English person, an right, English master.
Yes, you're an English master now. So
yeah, I probably should have known that. and I was... So within the first minute or so at the opening scene at the billiard hall, I had to pause the movie and go on Wikipedia and look this up. And I was like, holy shit, like, how have I not heard of this before? And it was amazing, like, in some kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, even, like, it's such an odd, unconventional movie.
Yes.
Like, those opening minutes, like, right before the billiards hall scene, there's, like, a minute of just straight, like, clouds moving.
Yeah.
In black and white cinematography. It's just clouds moving and, like, the percussion-y score in the background. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, it. And then the billiards hall scene.
Yeah, and as soon as I looked up that Stuart Copeland had done the score.
Yes.
It all came together and made sense.
Yeah, Stuart Copeland, for those unfamiliar, was the drummer for The Police.
Yes, and he's a phenomenal drummer. And it reminded me a lot, the score itself, which plays the audio engineering is as a whole plays a huge role in this movie. So I feel like maybe we'll end up talking about that a lot. But the score itself was very reminiscent of Brick for me. Ryan Johnson film, just the very percussive, like, it sounds like whatever, they're using the same instrument for whatever it is.
Okay, yeah.
And that there's kind of about teen gangs in there also, so I don't know, maybe this is a huge influence on Ryan Johnson, and if not, I'm going to pretend like it is, because I feel like it makes that movie, makes Brick even cooler.
Fair enough, Brick is awesome.
oh yeah, but Rumblefish.
But Rumblefish. yes, and Rumblefish, this film is shot in black and white. And the cinematography in this movie is really interesting. It takes like a lot of like French New Wave and Germanic Expressionistic techniques, and kind of adds like a film noir feel to the whole thing.
Yeah, which I was on board for because noir is my jam.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Who doesn't love noir? A good good old fashioned noir. Yeah. There are a couple of instances of color in the movie, similar to say like Schindler's List, where you see the Rumblefish in the pet store that are like red, blue, and green. And also Rusty James's reflection at the end of the movie is in color. So there's that. What does it mean? Who knows? Maybe we'll find out in this discussion. But
deep, man.
And the cast in this movie is just, I think, great. Matt Dillon as the lead role, Rusty James. Rusty James is one of those characters where you have to say their first and last name anytime you address them.
And they say it all the time. Every sentence either begins or ends with Rusty James.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Charlie Brown.
Yeah, correct.
Like at the beginning of the movie, like Lawrence Fishburne comes in and is like, yo, Rusty James. what's his name? Biff Wilcox is looking for you, Rusty James. Yeah.
And that opening scene kind of, for me at least, was, I don't know if it's because it's black and white and the way they were talking, but it seemed like a Tarantino moment.
A little bit. Yeah, it's very stylistic.
Like just the way when it's very high stylized, and when he's, you know, and he says that, he's talking about killing you, and he says, well, talking's not the same as doing, and then he, like, hits the eight ball or whatever, and it's like, it was so badass.
Yeah, the movie does a lot to paint Rusty James as a really cool character at the beginning, and then periodically, like, show you throughout the movie how he's not as cool as he is. Like, he's always living in the shadow of his brother, and he's always making dumb decisions. So it... Makes you like fall for this character at the beginning, like, wow, this guy's so cool, and then realize over time how like uncool this guy is, and how
and just how tragic his life is.
Yeah, exactly. Playing Rusty James' brother is Mickey Rourke as Motorcycle Boy.
Yeah, remember when Mickey Rourke looked like that?
Yeah, yeah, he messed up his face pretty bad. And Mickey Rourke's really great in this movie.
He was phenomenal.
Yeah, he's really cool. He's really mysterious. He's the guy that, like, you think Rusty James is the beginning of the movie. You know, you think Rusty James is that cool, like, in control character. Mickey Rourke's the actual one. And Rusty James is kind of living in his shadow. And everybody in town looks up to Motorcycle Boy as, like, this character who's, like, sort of a legend around town. There's, like, the entire town looks up to Motorcycle Boy in their way. Like, you see, like, throughout the movie, you see graffiti that says the Motorcycle Boy reigns and stuff like that. Like, people are always looking up to him, always talking about Motorcycle Boy as this, like, mysterious, cool figure.
Yeah, he's kind of like the underground kid messiah, sort of, everyone. I mean, they make a point to mention that he's only 21 or something like that. All these kids are in high school, I guess, but they all look super old. At least they even make the joke about that, too.
Yeah.
His role is very, very, I don't know how else to put it, not messiah. I mean, prodigal son, I don't know, how, you know, it's got a very biblical bent to it. I mean, at the beginning of the film, he's gone. They mention, you know, he's been gone for 2 months and nobody knows where he's been, and then he shows back up and everything changes.
Right. Yes, Dennis Hopper's also in this movie for a couple scenes as their father, who's always, like, drinking and always has a cigar in his mouth.
Yeah, really sweaty. Everyone's really sweaty in this movie.
Yes, but he does.
I was just going to point out, I like the choice of Coppola to make everything very uncomfortable, even down to there's a lot of close-ups, everyone's very sweaty and gross, and, like, the angles are very odd, and it's disconcerting to watch, and I think that's, you know, an interesting way to, a lot of people would look up to these characters as being the cool, like, punk underground, well, not punk, but, you know, the hood kids, but he shows that this is actually a terrible thing, this is a terrible life to be a part of,
right?
And I think that's cool.
Yes, yeah,
that Coppola does that.
Yes, and Diane Lane is also in this movie, as Patty, Rusty James's girlfriend. I just watched The Outsiders pretty recently, as research for this movie.
Because, look at you, Pete. You're always prepared.
Because I'm a professional. And I've now come to the conclusion that I am in love with the 80s Diane Lane. she's mega attractive. On my notes here, I just have the words Diane Lane and I drew a heart around them.
Oh, that's amazing.
But she's really solid in this movie. She's really good. Everybody in this cast is really good. Tom Waits is in this movie also as Benny, the owner of the store. And he even gets, like, it's a really small role, but he gets, like, this weird scene in the middle of the movie where he just kind of has this monologue, this voiceover monologue where it's just him, like, cleaning the bar. And it's about, like, how time is always passing. And
I took a note about that. I said, I just want Tom Waits to follow me around, chew gum, and give a monologue about the frivolousness of time. Because that's what the whole, like, 3-minute monologue is about, and it's amazing.
yeah, it's really good.
But that moment, I think, like, the chewing gum I hear is a testament to the audio engineering in this film, for me at least.
Yes.
Did you watch it on a TV or your computer with headphones or anything? How did you listen to it?
I was watching it on a TV. I didn't have headphones. Okay.
Because having it with headphones with stereo or surround sound was amazing. Because there's the scene when Motorcycle Boy Steve, I think, and Rusty James go to the strip that cross the river.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of conversation and music and stuff, and it's all swirling in the audio mix. Like, it's going from side to side.
Yeah.
And it was a phenomenal experience to have that. So, but the scene when Tom Waits is having this monologue, he's chewing gum, and it's so painfully obvious that he's just like... It's awesome. It's really fun. Like, it's a really cool detail to have in that.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah, the audio in this movie is great. There's also... that scene on the strip is a scene where... All that noise gets, like, drowned out, and it's just Motorcycle Boy having this monologue to Rusty James about the time that their mother left.
Right.
And it's this, like, really, like, minute-long monologue or so. It's, like, relatively long, and you just hear, like, everything kind of, like, quiets down, and you just hear Motorcycle Boy, and, like, everything else is, like, in a soft, like, echoey kind of thing.
It kind of all fades away.
Yeah, but you can still hear it. It's just like muffled.
Right.
It's really well done. It's really effective. There's a lot of stuff like that in this movie. There's a lot of unique scenes. One of the scenes that really jumped out at me was the scene where Rusty James and Steven were attacked in an alley, and mm-hmm. Rusty James, it looks like he dies, and like his body, his
right.
like kind of like leaves his soul, like leaves his body, and he has like an out of body experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really like visually unique sequence because I don't think I've ever seen that in anything outside of like cartoons.
That's true.
And you see like him kind of floating through town, like seeing like various people talking about him, mm-hmm. which I thought was really interesting.
That was really cool. That was an oddly like fantastical moment in this movie, because this movie is, you know, very realistic in some way.
Yeah.
You know, there's no weird things happening. And then Rusty James has this out-of-body experience.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's bits like that throughout. Like, I think there's a weird, like, dreamlike quality
there is, that's
throughout,
true.
Throughout the movie. And, like, Rusty James has these visions of, like, Patty in her underwear.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, you're right.
During the, like, just periodically throughout the film. Mm-hmm. And stuff like that. So I think there's sort of, like, a dreamlike thing
that
there.
That is true. Yeah. I didn't think of that, actually. You're right. And the way the clouds are always, always moving very fast, and the like persistence of clocks in this film.
Yes, a lot of clocks. It's very much a one of the running themes of this movie, and I was like researching it after I watched it, was that time is always running out.
Right.
And that's part of what Coppola was trying to convey with Stuart Copeland's score, was that like the percussion's always like moving really fast and moving like as yeah. if like, you know, trying to get somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, in the along with the Tom Waits monologue.
Yes, yeah.
Cage shows up in the first minute. That's a note I have.
I have that note, too. And we will talk about Cage in a little bit. I mean, one of the things, you've seen The Outsiders, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I think this is a really interesting companion piece to The Outsiders, because we've said, like, they're both based on S.E. Hinton novels. They both, like, mm-hmm. are directed by Francis Ford Coppola. They both star many of the same people, and they're both about similar things. But this is a much more, like, art house version of that story, as opposed to The Outsiders, which is relatively conventional. It's a really well-shot... The Outsiders is a really well-shot movie and well-made and well-produced, but I feel like that movie is, you know, just feels very conventional, whereas this one feels like it's really trying something different and new.
Yeah. And I applaud that a lot. I don't know many Stuart Coppola movies outside of, you know, the big four, you could say.
Francis Ford Coppola. Yes. Well, that's the thing. Francis Ford Coppola's career is one that really fascinates me, because he made four of the best movies ever made.
Yeah.
Like, in a row, in the 70s. You know, he made The Godfather, he made The Conversation, The Godfather Part II, and then Apocalypse Now. And that was, the 70s is kind of widely regarded as, like, the most artistically viable time in a studio, mm-hmm. for studios in Hollywood. And from that point on, it was harder for, like, big movies like Apocalypse Now to get made. And so his career after that is relatively hit or miss. Like, there's a lot of really interesting movies, like The Outsiders, Rumblefish. And then there's, you know, lousy movies. Like,
yeah.
he directed Jack with Robin Williams, which is one of the worst movies ever made. Like, that movie is terrible. I don't know if you've ever seen Jack.
Is that when he grows up really fast?
Yeah.
That's a Francis Ford Coppola movie.
Yeah, he directed that.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's awesome, I guess. But yeah, so not that that's awesome, but I was excited to discover this movie, like, personally for me.
Yes.
Is this something that I would love? Like, this was great. I had this experience of watching this movie was awesome. I don't know.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm sort of excited about this podcast because I've seen the big four Coppola movies, and I've seen a few Coppolas here and there.
Mm-hmm.
I actually own his first movie on DVD. It's called Dementia 13, and it was a Roger Corman film.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I have it in like a Roger Corman collection.
Nice.
So I have that. And I've seen a few couple of movies here and there, but I haven't seen a ton of his stuff post the 1970s. And so this podcast is going to give me the opportunity to see three Francis Ford Coppola movies I haven't seen before, one of which is Rumblefish. We're also going to be watching The Cotton Club and Peggy Sue Got Married.
Right.
Which is actually one of his bigger movies, Peggy Sue Got Married. That's a pretty well-known movie. But I'm excited for those. That should be interesting.
Yeah. And it's Just another note about the movie, this and The Outsiders. It's cool. I like that Coppola did them back-to-back. Like, he filmed them together.
Yeah, almost. Like around the same time.
Yeah. And it's awesome to see S.E. Hinton keeping the same themes in some kind of way. Like, the gang fight in the very beginning is right. Very reminiscent of something from The Outsiders, where it's like the greaser hood kids fighting the kids in the Madras shirts, because all those other people, the right. other gang, are like kind of dressed up a little bit, and that's very much reminiscent of The Outsiders.
Yes, yeah, both movies are about very similar things, but I think this movie really delves into the psychology of the members of the gangs, or at least...
Way deeper, yeah.
Or at least Rusty James' psychology in any case.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was awesome. That was very interesting to watch.
Also, I want to talk about the end of this movie. At the end of this movie, Motorcycle Boy dies while trying to free the Rumblefish and put them back in the river. Mm-hmm. And the long take that shows every character's reaction to Motorcycle Boy's death is incredible. Like that.
Yeah.
That was really great. And that's right after Rusty James leaves the scene. Like, you see Motorcycle Boy's death, and it's just this long take of a crowd gathering around. Mm-hmm. And you see, Dennis Hopper's character just grab a drink and start drinking. You see Nicolas Cage and Diane Lane show up and like, oh, what's going on? What's going on?
Right.
That kind of thing. And you see every character in the movie reacts to Motorcycle Boy's death, because his death has an impact on virtually everyone.
The whole neighborhood, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was oddly prescient to me, at least, with all the, police brutality stuff you hear in the news now, that cop killed Motorcycle Boy just because he didn't like him, basically.
True, yeah.
I don't know, that was a weird connection for me to have.
Yeah,
this movie.
Yeah, well, Motorcycle Boy's death basically comes because he's trying to free some fish from a pet store. That's like his...
Yeah, that's true.
It's could be seen as a very meaningless death.
Yeah, and it could almost be a, not suicide, but he knows what he's doing.
Yeah,
like,
I think
Rusty James in that scene is telling him, like, the cop, we saw you here all day, like, you're casing the place, don't break in, like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. That was weird.
Yes.
And interesting.
Yes.
It's almost like he knew he had to die in order for Rusty James to survive.
Sure.
In some way.
Yes.
Because he tells him to take the motorcycle and leave.
Yeah. And he's doing it while taking out the fish, and the fish are the only element of this movie that are in color. You see them in red, you see them in blue, you see them in green. And he has a monologue about the Rumblefish. They're called the Rumblefish. And he's saying that they're the fish that, if they were together, they would be fighting each other if they had the chance.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not. They're, separated. And they have, a whole scene where it's like they're pointing the mirror to the fish, and the fish tries to fight themselves. And that's a pretty clear metaphor for, Motorcycle Boy and Rusty James themselves. Like, they are the Rumblefish in their own ways.
Yes. Yeah, he says that if given the room to live, they wouldn't fight each other. That's why he wants to put them in the river and take them out of the pet store.
Exactly.
And these kids are stuck in the town. They got nothing to do. They're going to fight each other. And he recognizes that.
Yep. Yes. And, so the movie ends...
Analysis.
Yeah, and the movie ends... at the end of that long take, you see the silhouette of Rusty James on Motorcycle Boy's motorcycle driving away. And then it ends. The final shot of the movie is Rusty James making it to the ocean, which Motorcycle Boy could never do.
Right.
Which I thought was interesting. That's he finally...
California got in the way.
Yeah, California got in the way. Rusty James spent his entire life under Motorcycle Boy's shadow, and once Motorcycle Boy dies, Rusty James can finally do something the Motorcycle Boy has never done.
That's interesting, yeah. Metaphors.
Yes. all right. Is there anything else you want to talk about in the movie, Mike, before we move on to talking about Cage?
No, we can talk about Cage.
You want to talk about Cage?
If I think of it, I'll bring it back up.
Okay. All right. Yeah, let's talk about Cage. So Cage is a supporting character in this movie. He plays Smokey, a member of Rusty James's gang. He has really, really tall hair.
I just got a weird pompadour kind of thing going on.
Yeah, it's like Elvis, but then times two kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's really tall, which is just a weird little aside. And I think Smokey doesn't have that much to do throughout the movie, but he has a couple big scenes. And he's basically there at the beginning, kind of egging Rusty James on into this gang fight. And he's sort of Rusty James' right-hand guy, at least as part of the gang, except for Steven. And Smokey has a problem with Steven. Steven's like this nerdy guy that Rusty James is friends with. Mm-hmm. And Smokey like chastises him about it early in the movie, saying like, you know, why do you hang out with him? And Rusty James is like, I've known him since kindergarten. Like, we're best pals. And Smokey, I think, has like a line at the beginning of the movie that kind of defines Rusty James throughout the film, which is that he gets too attached to people and like stays with them like forever.
Right.
So he says that about Steven, but it's very much also the case with Motorcycle Boy. Like, he gets too attached to the idea of Motorcycle Boy and living like with him and as his brother.
Yeah. I mean, there's the refrain that Rusty James has also that, what is it? When I grow up, I'm going to look just like him, about Motorcycle Boy.
Right.
And everyone constantly tells him that he doesn't look like him.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. Because he's not even that much younger than Motorcycle Boy. Like, he's in high school. Motorcycle Boy's a couple years out of high school. So, yeah, he's not going to look like Motorcycle Boy.
Got no more growing up to do.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Cage in the beginning, it appears, in the first 5 minutes or so, he's going to have a very prominent role in the film, but it kind of fades away after that gang fight for a while.
Pretty much. If this movie was more like The Outsiders, I'm sure Cage would have a bigger role, because that movie's more about the actual gang.
The gang, yeah.
Like, the ensemble, whereas this is more about Rusty James, like, just himself.
Mm-hmm.
But he does have he has a pretty big role in the beginning, and he has a scene about two-thirds of the way through the movie. Smokey steals Rusty James's girlfriend, Patty, which is Cage's biggest scene in the movie. And, you know, it's really, so earlier than that, like, maybe like 20 to 30 minutes before then, Smokey brings everybody up to this cabin, like, out on the lake, and they have an orgy.
Basically.
It's really...
They saw episode 5 of True Detective, or 6, and they were like, let's do that.
Yeah, it's a little bizarre, but
it's a little weird. We get to see Nick Cage's ass.
Yeah,
so that's cool.
That's true. but while there, Rusty James cheats on his girlfriend.
Yes,
and she breaks up with him because she finds out. And during this scene, it's revealed that she shows up at the diner, and Rusty James goes to talk to her, and then Cage like butts in and sits next to her, like puts his arm around her, and then he ends up talking to Rusty James, and it reveals that he orchestrated the entire thing. Like, the whole reason they had this orgy was that so it would get back to Patty, and so she would dump Rusty James, and he can move in.
Yeah,
which is
the long con, I guess.
it's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah,
but it worked.
It does work.
Yeah,
and that scene when they're talking outside, we do get there's two moments where the theme of time passing for me really stands out, and one of them is when they're having this conversation and we see the reflection of the sky in the window they're leaning against, and the clouds are just flying past, and it's another moment for them to hammer that down.
Yes.
And then the other one was when Rusty James and Motorcycle Boy are leaving like the drugstore or something like that, when they find the magazine article with the picture of Motorcycle Boy, and they go out and talk to the cop, and they're leaning against a giant clock that's on a truck for some reason.
Yes.
They're talking. Yeah, I don't know. That was just the other big glaring moment.
Yeah, there are clocks throughout this movie, like all over the place. And Cage also, Cage to me, whenever he's on screen, seems to be like, he's just always able to like give it to Rusty James straight. Like, this is your problem.
He's kind of the voice of reason. Like, he doesn't want to go to the gang fight that everyone else wants to go to.
Right. And he's telling Rusty
James... Because he knows they're just going to die.
Yeah, he's telling Rusty James, like, you're not a leader like your brother was. You ain't got your brother's brains, is what he says. Nobody wants to be killed. Like, it's kind of like... Mm-hmm. You know, in all reality, it seems like Smokey would be a much better leader than Rusty James would be. I think that's kind of what he's trying to be. Like, he's trying to lead the gang himself.
Yeah, I think he even says that, actually, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think he said that if it wasn't for your brother, like, I would easily be the leader of this gang, not you.
Not you, yeah. So that was just Cage foreshadowing his career, because he will clearly be a leader.
Yes.
I don't know. I tried. I tried.
You tried. No. Yeah. But for the most part, I think Smokey's a relatively static character. He doesn't do much.
Yeah.
He doesn't do much aside from steal Patty from Rusty James. And he's mostly there to inform Rusty James's journey throughout the film. Mm-hmm. I do like his line, during that conversation. He's like, oh, yeah, even if she wasn't your chick, I'd still like her.
Yeah. I was like, what?
Like, that doesn't make him feel better. Like, what are you talking
about? Yeah. I don't know if it was supposed to be, kind of try to console him that, like, oh, I'm not doing it just because it's against you. But that doesn't do any, like, what?
Right. There's also, during that scene, there's, like, a really short bit where it's just Cage is, like, looking in the mirror, like, looking in the window, and just seems fascinated by his own reflection.
I didn't even think of it that way. When he's when they're having this conversation outside.
Yeah, like, briefly, he's just kind of, like, looking there and, like, whoa. So, like, he's fascinated. And he's not, like, being conceited and, like, fixing his hair or anything. He's just, like, staring at himself. Like,
yeah. The way I interpreted that was that he was looking through the window, like, back at Patty. But I realize now that he is, like, the actual scene, what you see is him just looking at his reflection. That's so good. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Nick Cage. I mean, who wouldn't be enthralled by him, right?
Right, exactly. We're doing a whole podcast about him, so.
Yeah, so whatever he's got, we like.
Exactly. Well, no. let's not go that far.
Okay. All right, you're right. I'll take it back.
But, yeah, so that's Cage and... That is Cage and Rumblefish. I don't know if you have anything else about his performance that you want to talk about, Mike.
No, not much. He's not in much. He doesn't do a whole lot.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, he's a solid supporting character in this movie, but really, yeah. Really, this movie is Matt Dillon's, and he does a lot of great work here. I think it's surprising to me that his career hasn't, like, flourished in a long time. I feel like I haven't seen him in that much in a really long time.
Yeah, I don't really can't think of anything recent, at least.
Yeah, I know he's in he's on a miniseries on Fox called Wayward Pines that's airing. Or just finished airing. It's airing. It's
over. Yeah.
Yeah. But I know he was on that. I didn't watch that. I heard mixed reviews, so I'm not
totally. Yeah, wasn't it? That was an M. Night Shyamalan thing, right?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
I think it was.
Okay.
Whatever. I didn't watch it. Maybe I will. I don't know.
But between this and The Outsiders, like, I've gained a new appreciation for Matt Dillon's work. I think he's really great in these two movies. And so I'd like to see him in some more cool stuff.
Maybe he'll be season two of The Complete Works.
What? Maybe he'll be season two.
Maybe we'll do season two. Yeah, of The Complete Works.
Maybe. I was actually thinking about who season two could be, and I was just thinking, like, Tom Cruise. Because Tom Cruise.
Oh, my God.
Because don't you love Tom Cruise, man? Like, I just think he's
I would watch it. I would do that. That's if we ever finish season one, because we have about 150 more movies to do because you picked Nicolas Cage.
Yep. Yeah, that was dumb. But here we are.
Whatever. Yep, here we go.
We're going to do it, though. We'll
be in year two by the time we finish this.
Yeah. All right. So I guess that about wraps it up for Rumblefish. Mike, is there anything more about the movie itself you want to talk about?
I want to own this, basically. This is a movie I would purchase. I hope that there's a Blu-ray of it, because I want it.
Yeah, it's a really great movie, really relatively underseen, and it's... You know, if you're only familiar with Coppola through his big four movies, this is definitely something you should check out. It's definitely, like, worthy of your time. It's really different from his four, like, 70s movies, too. It's really, like, him kind of leaving Hollywood behind and going, like, super crazy, weird, and experimental. So yeah. It's definitely worth checking out. All right. So, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
Find me on twitter.com/mdfilmblog.
Yes, you can find me at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog. I also podcast about various things on filmbook.com, like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and whatnot. Thank you for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. It's Mike Tricio. If you're listening to this video via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to our podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email. We produce so many different ones, hard to keep track. We'd love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks, where we will be discussing Nicolas Cage and Richard Benjamin's Racing to the Moon. And check out this week's film bookcast, where Mike and I will be reviewing the new movie in the newly rebooted Marvel franchise, Fantastic Four. Thank you so much for listening, guys. We are out.